are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, July 26, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Dayen. On the Democrats' new platform, the Republicans edging out onto the plank and making way for all pair. All those stories David Dayen will bring us today. Meanwhile, Republicans go forward toward the health care cliff. And Trump can't get rid of his racist, vote-suppressing attorney general to quit. That said, his secretary of state is taking a little breather. Yeah, he's taking a break. Democrats win a key state Senate special race in New Hampshire. And why the word painful in the sentence, Russia warns of painful response if Trump backs sanctions, is spelled P-E-E-T-A-P-E. Meanwhile, Trump bans transgender recruits from the military. And Senate Dems are going to stop Trump from making recess appointments. Rick Perry, of course, gets pranked by Russian prank callers. And, well, all that and more on today's program. Oh, I guess I had Senate drops Manafort a subpoena. He's going to testify willingly and provide some information to the Senate. At least that's what it appears. So all that and more. And yesterday, of course, we had anticipated what was going to happen in the Senate. Certainly we were talking about it quite a bit in the fun half of the program because that's the way that we roll. It's so fun to talk about what the Senate's going to do. Look, it can't always be fun. It can't always be. We did spend a half an hour doing Jeff Sessions impressions.
And it's fun when there are hot mics.
And we have the hot mics, right. We got hot mics. Hot mics. We'll play that sound, of course, today.
Mr. President, you really think I've been dedicating my entire life to restoring the glory of a certain heritage? You think you humiliating me for a couple of weeks is really? I got a plan here where being Mexican.
I've got I got Mexicans to send home.
What if being Mexican was a crime and therefore made all Mexicans eligible for civil forfeiture?
Well, actually,
how's that for the Treasury?
He did come out today. I mean, there's all sorts of stories. Like literally, like his confidants are saying he's pissed.
And, I'm pissed.
So pissed. I think what I should do is investigation into some leaks. How's that? Does that sound good?
That sound good.
How about investigations into some leaks that may have been done by black people? Would that be good?
Steam's coming out of my goddamn ears. I haven't been this angry since they made a holiday out of that goddamn agitated Martin Luther goddamn king.
I promise to harass as many Latinos as I can find in the administration for leaking. But however, I'm at a loss to find any. Oh, excuse me.
If there were Puerto Ricans on staff, I think we'd know who the leakers were. You all know how them people take care of their property.
I'll be heading down to the servant quarters to see who's been leaking.
We don't have a servant quarters? I am pissed.
I was on All In last night. Maybe we'll pull that clip, and it will give me more opportunity to talk about how just unbelievably I mean, look, I don't usually get into hypocrisy and that type of stuff, and but I want to talk about John McCain. That tweet that I tweeted out the other night when he was diagnosed with brain cancer is looking more and more sort of undersold as possible. God. However, I do have some very good news. I mean, I don't know if everybody's going to think it's good news.
But
hello? Well, here it is.
Here we go.
So, I started my 30-day yoga retreat. Now, I got sidelined because I had to go to... I had to leave town because of some illness in the family the other day. Well, not the other day, a week or two ago. But so I'm back on it. Here is, well, this is pretty exciting. It's I'm doing it through Beachbody on Demand. I do not have such expectations, but at the very least, I will not get mocked by my children around my own house.
Put
it that way.
Or so, it could be like a beach, like in Little Odessa. With, like, you and a bunch of old Ukrainians.
Possibly. But Beachbody On Demand is an online fitness streaming service. It gives you unlimited access to a massive variety of highly effective world-class workouts. You can stream over 600 different workouts, including PIO. Or is it PO? I started to watch some of that. PO is what I'm going to do next. They also have P90X, which I will never do because I just don't. I'm not in that kind of shape. But 21-day fix and more, all from your web-enabled device. Also, you get extensive nutritional content, which of course helps you get to your fitness goals. And they have a brand new, first of its kind cooking show for healthy weight loss and portion control called Fixate. It has over 100 recipes. All right, so here's the deal. So you go in, you join, you choose. There's like, I don't know, at least a dozen or two different styles of workout. I have, and we used to talk about this a long time ago, Michael, about me taking yoga.
Yes, we did. I was an avid encourager.
I have had interest in taking yoga for, well, probably a decade. But
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was going to say at least a couple years. Okay, a decade.
Yeah, at least a couple years. But I think the thing that has kept me going into the door, aside from the fact that, just broadly speaking, I'm not a huge fan of exercise, but you want to eliminate any obstacles. It's like, I don't want to go in there and not know what the hell I'm doing. So I'm taking this 30-day yoga retreat. I'm probably going to take closer to 40 days to finish it. But it's Vetus. It's the guy from Survivor. Was like, I'm like, I know this dude, and he was on Survivor, and then they rotate the three of them, and it's good. It's imminently doable. I'm doing it.
They should put that on the box. Imminently doable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the way it is for me. And so, you know, I'm just getting into it, but. For me, I mean, aside from, like, I'm not expecting to see results in the first couple of days, but I do feel like by the end of this, I'm going to feel comfortable. If I want to go take yoga somewhere else, like actually in a place, I can do that. But this is super easy because I can go when my kids are still sleeping. I can actually do this. It's a brand new service, but has already over 1 million members. And now you can claim a free trial membership when you text the word majority to 303030. So that's 303030. So you dial that and then you text. Well, you don't dial it. You put it into your text. And you text the word majority. And you will get full access to this entire platform for free trial membership. All right. So John McCain, he flies in after brain surgery. He gets a huge amount of applause. Do we have that video? Here, okay, here, play this. Is it? Oh, okay, no. So he gets a huge amount of applause from his Senate colleagues, which I have sort of mixed feelings about. Okay, he's sick, you applaud him, but he comes back. The reason for him coming back was so gratuitous. And so then he votes for the motion to proceed and says, I'm not going to vote for the underlying bill, but that he feels it's important. There's debate, et cetera, et cetera. And then he goes on delivers a 15-minute, highly self-righteous, sanctimonious speech. Here's a clip of it, okay?
And on our nobility. It accounts for our imperfections and gives us an order to our individual strivings that has helped make ours the most powerful and prosperous society on earth. It is our responsibility to preserve that. And even when it requires us to do something less satisfying than winning, even when we must give a little to get a little, even when our efforts managed just 3 yards in a cloud of dust while critics on both sides denounce us for timidity, for our failure to triumph. I hope we can again rely on humility, on our need to cooperate, on our dependence on each other, to learn how to trust each other again, and by so doing better, serve the people who elected us. Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them. They don't want anything done for the public good. Our incapacity is their livelihood. Let's trust each other. Let's return to regular order. We've been spinning our wheels on too many important issues.
All right, stop. I don't even need to hear any more of this. Okay, hold on, listen. So, first off, when he says regular order, what he's talking about is they never used to have these motion to proceeds. Because it used to be just a voice vote or just, you know, everybody, it was never questioned. Of course, you're going to proceed to the bill. You're going to debate it. This was, for all intents and purposes, a relatively new, I mean, and it would happen occasionally, but very, very rarely. To the extent that regular order no longer exists, it's because during the Obama administration, Mitch McConnell basically innovated the idea that every single bill would be filibustered. Every single bill. So every single bill had to go through this. You remember all those times that John McCain complained about it then? It's not because you don't have a good memory. It's because he never did it. Speaking of not listening to the sort of the margins, right? The critics on their margins and the people on the radio. Two words, Sarah Palin. There is no Donald Trump without Sarah Palin being elevated because she lowered the standards for everything. Don't make it all about winning in parentheses, in quotes. John McCain picked Sarah Palin because he thought that was his only chance to win. He didn't give a crap that she was an idiot. He didn't give a crap that she was dangerous. Really dangerous. Like a threat to the country. I mean, I don't know what would happen if something happened to John McCain if he was president and Sarah Palin became president. I imagine in some respects it might look very similar to what's going on with Donald Trump. Maybe it would be worse. Because she would be out there doing what Trump is doing, but there would be people probably who had a more specific agenda. Who knows? But he opened this door. And now the idea that he's going to be self-righteous about it is just absurd. And then just to put a little cherry on top, that bill that he said he wouldn't vote for, 4 hours after he gave that speech, he voted for that bill.
What's his entire career?
Listen, none of this is going to come to a surprise to anybody who listens to the show or has been listening to this show for any extended period of time. But this is who that guy is.
He's a conventional right-wing corporate Republican who knows how to give provocative quotes and play sanctimonious for idiots on cable news who praise that same speech.
It was
unbelievable.
The other thing this exposes is just sort of the vacuousness of what we used to call high broderism after David Broder, who's no longer with us, God bless. But this idea that like this Washington Beltway perspective where, you know, there's some notion of like, it's important. I mean, I think there was even some senator who said, maybe it was Blumenthal. It's like, yeah, his vote's not as important as his speech. Bull crap. Nobody's listening to John McCain in his caucus anyways.
That's a shockingly stupid
comment. He opened the door to this stuff. So F John McCain, and thank you for your service. What a hero. What a hero. Man. Now, I will say this. There are times where I need to kick back. I need to get out of the office.
Take a breath.
I need to take a breath. I need to get out of the office so I don't have to deal with the scurrying that goes around here. All these people working so intensely at this office.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Exactly. No, look, there's a lot of different reasons why people do off-sites. Whether you have an office, big company, mid-sized company, you might want to do off-sites with smaller groups of people. Or, you know, when I was an actor and I'd be doing auditions all over town or L.A., I'm going all over town. I need an hour or two. I want to go write somewhere. Don't want to go to the coffee shop and see seven other guys who look identical to me typing away at their computer with thinking they, like me, have the next big, you know, everybody doesn't love Raymond or whatever it is.
Everyone's got a problem with Raymond. That's mine, do you see?
So you want to go to a convenient location. You want it to feel semi-professional, at least, right? Highly professional. You want there to be good Wi-Fi. Breather has beautiful, inspiring workspaces for your offsites, your team meetings, your client meetings, even individual work. You're a therapist. I don't know why a therapist would ever get an office anymore. The best part is because you only pay for the time you need. A month, a day, even just an hour. There's no minimums, no commitments. You can get on your app and you can book a room literally minutes before you go there. It's in LA, New York, San Francisco, Palo Alto, Boston, Chicago, DC, Toronto, Montreal, and London. And they're growing. Started in Canada. Started, I think, in Montreal.
Oh, we really love it then.
Yeah. Even Google, Apple, and Facebook employees use Breather for their offsites and team meetings. And as you can imagine, they have gorgeous offices. Don't overpay for space you don't need. Book a Breather space for the time you need it and spend hundreds, not thousands. I mean, the ones that are around the corner here in Brooklyn, they're tens for an hour. Try Breather right now and you'll receive $100 off your first booking when you go to breather.com/majority. That's $100 off your first booking when you go to breather.com/majority. Breather.com/majority. Breather, as in like, I breathe, and now I'm a breather. .com/majority. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, David Dan. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome back to this program, perhaps maybe our most frequent guest ever. It's very possible. I mean, second probably most frequent. Ladies and gentlemen, David Dayan. You can read his work in The Intercept, New Republic, Pacific Standard, The Nation. What's the Pacific Standard? That's something different?
I think I did one thing for them 4 years ago.
Oh, well, all right. Pacific Standard. I mean, I still remember that one. What else? Where else? I mean, everywhere. Everywhere. Why don't you settle down? Why are you so...
Not Majority FM. Never been asked.
Well...
Never been asked.
Well, wait a second. Now, in my defense, we don't... we link to your stuff all the time, but I will say this. I did, when I was the editor, I don't know if you remember this, at Air America, of the Air America website, I did pull from your site, from D-Day, that blog spot you had.
Oh, that's right. I forgot to serve you with papers for copyright infringement.
I believe, actually, we paid you it was basically Starbucks coffee, I think, gift cards or something like that. No, we definitely paid. We definitely paid. Not much, but we definitely paid.
If you would like to write for our blog, you are very much welcome to do so, and I will be in touch.
There you go. Boom.
Like to see a couple more clips,
David. So let's start with what happened yesterday in the Senate. You and Ryan Grimm writing at The Intercept, two of some of my favorite reporters who are not working for the CIA, you wrote well. So, where is it? Now, I have it right here. Don't be fooled by this Senate vote. The road to repealing Obamacare is just as long as it was yesterday. Now, I have a little bone to pick with you about this, but I want you to first explain what you mean by that, because I happen to think that it's the wrong metaphor. The road's just as long, but they have moved down it, is my take on this. But go ahead. Tell us what they were voting on yesterday.
Right. So Ryan and I have, I think, slightly different perspectives that we tried to fuse into this article. But, I mean, overall, what they voted on was the motion to proceed on the health care bill. And, you know, there is a sense that every step that senators take to immerse themselves in this task of repealing, it makes it that much harder for them to extricate themselves from that. And I think that's actually the strategy at this point. The Senate pretty much knows that they don't have the votes for the bill that they've been working on for 3 months. I mean, that's clear. They actually voted on it yesterday, the Better Care Reconciliation Act, and they got 43 votes, which was pretty shockingly low, considering this was the comprehensive replacement package that they had been working on since the beginning of the year. They know they don't have votes, which they will actually do this vote later today, on just repealing outright the Affordable Care Act and waiting 2 years to come up with a replacement. They know they don't have the votes for that. They're going to vote on it anyway. But
now, is that measure
not going to happen?
Is that measure essentially equivalent to the 2015 bill that they passed in both houses, knowing that Barack Obama would veto it, and they didn't have the votes to override the veto? Okay, so they're all on record as voting for this before they vote against it, which will probably be today.
Yes. You know, what are they going to do in between that? They know that they are unable to, on a 50-vote basis, include a number of provisions that they put into the bill to fail yesterday, because the parliamentarian has already ruled that a number of those provisions would be out of order with the very Byzantine process of budget reconciliation, which we don't really need to go into. But we know that a lot of those provisions would take 60 votes rather than 50 votes. And, you know, with only 52 Republicans in the Senate, they don't have the ability to take those votes.
Let me just very briefly, I think people are at least vaguely familiar. This is done under a reconciliation, a budget resolution that involves reconciliation, which is 50 plus one. And the only rules that sort of inhibit that or constrain that are the so-called Byrd rules. And that basically means that anything that's in the bill has to directly deal with the budget. And the parliamentarian ruled that a bunch of this stuff doesn't. Things like defunding Planned Parenthood, things like abortion restrictions for the tax code, things like funding for the cost-sharing subsidies, the medical loss ratio, and I think even most importantly, the six-month window where you can buy
which
into
is their version of the individual mandate. It's not a mandate, but it says
it's meant
if you
to do the
don't
same
have
thing.
Insurance, it effectively does the same thing. The continuous coverage provision. So all of that is out, right? So what are they going to do? Well, the emerging strategy appears to be that the Senate will come up with what they're calling skinny repeal. They'll take the things that they know their members, or at least they think their members, can all agree on. Repealing the individual mandate, which does actually have a budgetary impact. Repealing maybe the medical device tax, which is this tax on medical devices. And maybe repealing the employer mandate, which says that employers have to provide health insurance or pay into a fund. So they package that together and believe that, you know, they can get 50 votes for that. But the content of that is almost immaterial. The entire point is to get into what is known as a conference committee with the House. And the idea here is if the House passes a bill and the Senate passes a bill on, you know, the same subject, but there are differences between the bills, there is a conference committee set up to reconcile the two bills and come up with one product out of that conference that then, in this case, because it's under reconciliation, would get an up or down vote in both chambers.
And just to be clear, when you use the verb reconcile, you're just basically bringing the differences between the House version and the Senate version together. That is a different process from reconciliation, which allows for fit. Just so that people know, because I've seen people on Twitter get confused about that, and I just want to make that clear.
Right. Okay. Very good. So the whole idea now then is for the Senate to get to conference. And just think about the process. If you have the House, which has passed an actual bill, and the Senate, which has passed three measures that really don't really have any, you know, structure of a bill whatsoever, what do you think is going to come out of that conference committee? It's very likely that it will be the something that looks very much like the House bill. And the so-called moderates in the Senate that have resisted anything like the House bill will now have this decision to make. Because what will happen is at the end of this process, the House and Senate will be presented with a bill that they can't amend, that they're going to have to vote up and down, up or down on, and it will be a take it or leave it situation.
Yep.
In other words,
yep.
You either vote for this or Obamacare lives and wreaks the havoc that they believe it wreaks.
I would even articulate it this way. Mitch McConnell is going to say to Dean Heller and to Capito and to Portman, this is a vote between Obamacare or our care. So there is no, that's it. You're choosing either Obamacare and that's going to be, and there's one other wrinkle here though, right? Is that the House bill, because, you know, this is like any type of negotiation, you go in, if the people, that's why they always say like, you be the one to draw the paper up. They have the bill, they go into that situation. The House bill is not compliant with the Byrd rule, right? And so,
well, yes.
And so here's the big question, it seems to me, and what I was suggesting last night on Twitter is that it seems to me this means that they're going to go for the filibuster. That's going to be the first vote, right? Is going to be chuck the filibuster.
Well, what they can do is appeal the ruling of the parliamentarian. So they can, and that's essentially what was done to create the nuclear option. Like, for example, when Supreme Court justices could be not filibusterable. That's how they did it. So the parliamentarian says, well, you got to chuck this, 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 and this. And Vice President Pence can sit there and say, no, they don't. And that can be upheld by a 50 vote standard. So,
and
yes,
that effectively
possible.
That effectively destroys the filibuster, though, doesn't it? Right. I mean,
yeah, it does for the purposes of reconciliation bills. Now, that's one bill a year. But if you're saying effectively that one time a year, you don't have to deal with the 60 vote hurdle, then you're essentially going to have one bill a year in the Senate that has everything that needs, that's controversial in any way, thrown into it, right?
Yep.
That would be the precedent that would be set. But the other way that they could do that is to modify the language, work with the parliamentarian and try to come up with language that would work. It's certainly possible, or jettison, you know, this provision or that provision and, you know, squeeze, those who are in favor of those provisions in the same way that the moderates are going to get squeezed and understand how McConnell has sold his, the Portmans and the Capitos and the Hellers of the world on this bill. The first thing he said was, just get us to the motion to proceed, and you can amend the bill on the floor to your liking, no problem. Now what he's saying is, just get this over to conference, and we'll work it out there. Don't worry about it. And what he's going to say at the end, after these moderates get absolutely nothing that they want and will be presented with a bill that they've already been on the record for months as hating, he'll say, there's nothing else we can do. It's either this or Obamacare, take it or leave it.
Right.
So it's such a bait and switch that's being perpetrated, and willingly. I mean, these senators, it's painfully obvious what is going on, that they're walking into a death trap, and they're doing it with their eyes wide open.
And so do you think it's going to work? I mean, like,
that's the question. You brought up the Byrd rule problems, which are serious, serious problems for the bill. Number one. Number two, there's the question of Saints Order of John McCain. Will he show up for a vote ultimately on what, whether it's the vote for the end of this process to get the thing to conference, or whether it's the vote at after the conference is over? Will he be there? Because if you have two votes, Senator Collins and Senator Murkowski, who are against this thing and presumably will continue to be against this thing, and you lose McCain, then it's 50-49 and you can't pass the bill. So there are wild cards, there are variables here. And then there's the question of whether or not, Senator Heller and Capito and Portman will willingly walk into their own destruction. So, I don't think it's a done deal, but there is a path to, success. Now, the other question is whether, those on the right who have been kind of wary of something like the House bill will move forward on it. People like Rand Paul or Mike Lee, if they decide at the end of the process, no, this isn't to our liking, then maybe you. But they're going to, of course, be squeezed in the same way that Heller and Capito are going to be squeezed. So it's certainly not over. It's a question of whether there is a skinny repeal out there that everybody can agree on and live with. It's a question of whether senators are going to be willing to give up their own authority and their own ability to actually shape this bill. And there are questions about procedure, and there's questions about John McCain.
All right.
But that seems to be the variables to me.
As far as I can tell, John McCain is the only real one. I mean, the others, I mean, I think to a certain extent, you know, look, Mitch McConnell must have a plan. He must have a plan, because the downside of this is that he has stretched out and elongated a massive, massive loss, right? Like, I mean, this is, if he thought at the end of this that he didn't have at least a fighting chance, like a significant chance, and I guess sort of, you know, cross-reference with how important it is to do this in terms of what they want to do after this, it seems to me he would have just punted a long time ago. But he's basically driving right towards, you know, the cliff, and he must obviously think there's a bridge there.
Keep in mind how much of this is being done on the fly. I mean, literally, senators found out about this skinny repeal thing yesterday from reporters. Like, there has been no communication whatsoever. We saw during the debate over the motion to proceed this long conversation between Ron Johnson and Mitch McConnell. Johnson was the last senator who did not agree to the motion to proceed before finally voting yes. And there was this 10-minute conversation on the floor that, you know, we didn't have the NSA microphones to hear. But it was animated, and you know, you could see faces reddening. And I think it reflects some of the perspective within the Republican caucus in the Senate that they're not being dealt with honestly, that they're not being included in the process. And, you know, one senator at this point can really change the world here. So that you have to add that into the consideration.
In other words, what you're saying is they realize that Mitch McConnell is jamming it down their throats, I think, as they would say in Republican parlance.
That is a familiar term.
Or ramming or jamming. I don't know what it is. I mean, yeah, I think he's...
They're both ramming and jamming.
I think Mitch McConnell realized, like, okay, we've had 7 years to come up with a plan. We're not going to come up with a plan that everybody's going to sign on to. So this is going to be one of those things where it's like, I'm going to make everybody make the decision with as little time as possible so that they will just react to the most obvious forces, which is everybody who's around them, everybody on talk radio, and make the decision, not between this and some other sort of better possible option out there, but between this and you essentially voting for Obamacare. And
right. And you heard Dean Heller yesterday say that we're just looking to get this over with. You know, I mean, I think that's the end game for some of these senators. They think they can just, you know, get the pressure off and get this out of their hair. That's the way that they're thinking about something that's going to affect millions of people, that is incorporates 1/5 or 1/6 of the economy, and they're just looking to get it over with. I think that's as damning a quote about this entire process as any you could find.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And so give me a sense of, do you have an idea of what the timeline is now? So are we saying, like, so when do they vote for the skinny vote if they're going to do it, the skinny plan, basically the ticket to conference?
Mitch McConnell said he wants this done by Friday. So there's 20 hours of debate. It's down to about 15 now because some of it has already been taken. There's going to be a vote, I think it's 3:30 today, on repealing, you know, like the full repeal.
The 2015 measure, yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be today. There's going to be something at some point called a vote-o-rama, which is something that's unique to budget reconciliation, where it's an open amendment process where anyone can offer amendments. Ryan Grimm, my colleague at The Intercept, has said that Jeff Merkley has readied about 100 amendments to stretch out this process. You know, if enough members of Congress of the Senate do that, this could stretch well beyond Friday. But that's Mitch's game plan, is to make this over by Friday. At some point, he could put in sort of a manager's amendment, a substitution, which would be this skinny repeal bill. And then you would have to pass that in a final vote. So a lot of votes that are going to be taken. What they're about, we don't yet know what all the amendments are going to be. But we think that by the end of the week, we'll have some more clarity.
Okay, so let's assume that they actually do take that skinny vote.
Skinny repeal.
Skinny repeal. And so then it heads to conference. How long does that process take? Is this something that they're going to try and wrap up before they go away for a week and, you know, before they go away for Labor Day, let's say? Or is this something that they would have hang? Because it seems to me you don't.
It would have to hang because the House is leaving Friday. So it's not possible for this to get done before the end of August. It's something that would have to be, you know, worked out later in the year. There's no timeline for a conference committee. They can stretch on for as long as you know, the rest of the Senate session if they wanted to.
Don't they have to close out? Don't they have to close out though this reconciliation bill, because this is a 2017 one, and then they back up against 2018?
That's a separate issue, right? So. They want to do one reconciliation bill in 2017 and one reconciliation bill in 2018. If you're still in the conference committee, remember on Obamacare, reconciliation was used at the end of the process. That didn't finish until March of 2010. So there's no sort of structure whereby the reconciliation bill has to be done in the year of the reconciliation, as long as they put a budget resolution together, and that's a whole other mess, which I'm not sure is going to happen. As long as they put a budget resolution together for 2018, they can wrap up the conference committee and finish out the reconciliation process afterward.
All right.
I think, but I'm not positive on that. You should probably talk to someone with a little more.
What we definitely need to do is get more arcane about this so that we have absolutely just the people in this office listening. So, but I mean, I think, you know, there's no way to get any better clarity than we just got, folks. And so I thank you for that, David. All right. So let's move on to a couple of other issues that you've been writing about. One is the Democrats. Chuck Schumer somehow, I don't know, got some type of message last week, came out, publicly said, we've got to stop talking about blaming the Russians. It's our fault that we lost, and we've got to do something better. We've got to have, if you will, a better deal. And they introduced essentially an agenda, for lack of a better term, for the Democrats, a platform of sorts, much of which was not terribly, the word radical for any of it, but much of which was not terribly impressive. But there was a section on monopolies that made you very happy, and it's certainly something that we've been, you know, been talking to folks from Matt Stoller and Barry Lynn and Kasabil Rahman about over the past couple of months. And so just give us a sense of what's there and why that's encouraging to you.
Yeah, so this Better Deal agenda was, I guess, the beginning of a rollout of an economic platform for the Democrats. And there were three parts of this rollout. One was about drug prices, and one was about jobs, and this thing was about busting corporate monopolies. And that was sort of on the periphery of the Hillary Clinton campaign. She did a white paper on it, and you know, I mean, the content of the advertising in that campaign was notably, free of policy. But this goes further. I mean, this what the Democrats, and it's all Democrats, right? Because this is a unified campaign message for 2018.
Yep.
What they have put forward is really a sea change in how to think about monopolies, because, you know, the way that antitrust policy works today is it is really solely judged on what is known as consumer welfare standard. In other words, as long as a merger or a particular industry is judged to be good for consumers, maybe prices are lower, that's the only thing that matters, and you can agree to that merger.
This is the Robert Bork basically yes. test and change that came out of the University of Chicago during
right.
essentially
the
Reagan years.
Yeah, 70s and 80s. And this would reverse that. It would actually change what Democrats are calling for is to actually change those merger guidelines and say that you have to take into account what this is going to do to workers. You have to take into account what this is going to do to competitors. You have to take into account what this is going to do with respect to consumer data and privacy. You have to take into account what this might do to small businesses and suppliers and the supply chain in general. This would be an absolute sea change to include all of these things in, to think about wages and jobs in the context of these monopolies. It really gets to the heart of how the concentration of economic and political power has been at the heart of all of the challenges that we see in our economy today, and indeed in our politics today.
Yep.
And so for Democrats to get on the side of that and say, yes, this is the problem of our time, and we need to scrutinize all of these industries, some of them cited by name in the document, whether it was telecom or airlines or the beer industry got a mention. Notably, the banking industry did not. But I would argue that if you're going to crack down on mergers and acquisitions, you're taking away a major profit center from
right.
Wall Street. M&A is one of the largest at this point. Sources of profit for Wall Street. This was very promising. It's the right target. Now, do Democrats have the credibility to say that now we're a party that goes after corporate power? Maybe not yet. maybe they don't have the direct ability. I mean, over the years, we have seen Democratic campaigns going back to Bill Clinton in the 90s, who have run on sort of a populist message, Bill Clinton.
But nothing this specific. I mean, what's interesting, I want to get into the politics
right.
of this because we could see the nascent sort of outlines of this message. In some ways, it seems to me during the Gorsuch hearings where everybody, I mean, Franken was out in front, I think, in a lot of it. But even Dianne Feinstein at least parroted some of the notion of, like, you side with the big guys over the little guys, right? I mean, that's what
right.
this, that, I mean, so,
yeah.
So let me ask you this. So I've seen some critics who say, hey, the American public does not, first of all, the American public does not know what the words antitrust mean or refer to. They certainly
right.
do not know of the nuance between the Bork standard of consumer welfare
right.
and versus like societal welfare or, the broader implications of monopolies. And even if you were to explain to them, like, look, we're no longer going to just consider whether or not this lowest price is for you. It's unclear to me that a lot of people are going to go, wait a second. No, I want the thing that's going to lower prices for me. Right. I mean, this is
right.
that was the sort of whole dilemma with Walmart on some level.
Right.
So how does this translate? Well, two questions. How does this translate into a political message? And two, what is the point of this, of coming out and talking about this as an agenda? Like, what's the relationship between the people who do understand what this is and the ability of the Democrats to sell a message that is at least a manifestation or a derivation of the policy here?
I think it gets to the heart of a set of things that about the economy that every American knows. You know, this didn't happen in a vacuum. There was a lot of discussion and you know, investigation into what has been lacking in the Democratic message. And I think this sort of returns to a standard that we saw, you know, in the turn of the century in the 1930s about Democrats being a party of the people again. In a polling memo that was attached to this rollout, a pollster showed that 86% of all Americans agreed that the economy is in the hands of a few giant corporations that are getting stronger and stronger. And, you know, there aren't many 86% messages in our politics. I think that it's just hard for me to believe that people would be sort of wondering how you could translate a fight against corporate power into a political message. This is something that seems to me like a slam dunk. People understand that their hometown's Main Street shut down when Walmart came in, and all of the small business owners in their area could no longer stay in business. People understand that their cable bill is absolutely outrageous and goes up and up, and that they get this horrible quality of service anytime they ask something or call the consumer customer service line or anything like that. People understand that when they go out to a supermarket, that everything in the aisle is owned by the same company, practically. People understand this intuitively. They understand that the quality of things has degraded, that the price of things have gone up, that their friends and neighbors have been had their jobs outsourced because companies have moved away from their area, that the people who were the backbones of their neighborhoods have been unable to keep up with large conglomerates that have decided to compete with them. They understand that their local newspaper just laid off everybody, and everything in their newspaper is from the Associated Press wire because of the power of Google and Facebook to commandeer advertising within the media space. They realize, I mean, this just goes on and on and on. I could list literally everything in that we interface with in society, and there is a problem of concentration at the very top, and it connects to inequality. It connects to the Citizens United problem of political power being fed from extreme concentrations of economic power. You cannot name to me a difficult challenge that America faces domestically that isn't connected to this. So I feel that it is vital that a political party takes this on as a mantle, because as we've seen over history, nothing gets done on this without a movement, without people banding together and using their collective voice to say that we don't want this kind of control over our everyday lives put in the hands of a few giant corporations.
It's exciting that they're catching on at least with this, and hopefully this will be something that they can execute going forward. And it seems to be a little bit more coming out of Chuck Schumer, frankly, than Nancy Pelosi. And I wonder if that's how much of that is a function of the sincere beliefs of either one of them, and how much of a function of it is based upon the way they perceive their caucus, or
well, I mean, I don't care.
Right, exactly.
I don't care
exactly
if this is a sincere belief or not.
Right.
I mean, I think ultimately it's up to the people to make this a priority, and for politicians to then have to get out in front of the parade and claim that they were leading it.
Exactly.
That's how most things advance in America, particularly things that aren't, put together by a corporation to try to, fool the public into thinking that it's in their interest. So that's how you're going to have to do it. And if Democrats want to get in front of that and come along for the ride, I think it's great. And I'll take yes for an answer.
Yep. And now, look, I wanted to talk to you about the all payer program that's growing in Maryland, but I've held you already significantly longer than I had told you, and I knew I was lying even when I told you that, but this is crazy.
No problem.
We'll have you back on. We'll talk about this because this is intimately tied into Ben Jealous's campaign for the governorship of Maryland. Maryland is uniquely situated to have a fundamental change in healthcare. And you brought up in your piece, and like I say, we'll talk about this in the future, but the idea is we could see something like but it happened out of Saskatchewan in Canada and then spread to the rest of Canada. That's the way they got their universal single-payer healthcare
right
system. But we will talk about
right
that at another time. Or people could just go and read your piece on it I'm going to tell them the little backdoor secret that I have, that apparently I'm the only person who knows this. You can go to daviddayan.tumblr.com, and that's the only way to follow David Dayan, because he's in so many places: The American Prospect, Naked Capitalism, These Times, Penthouse,
question
Breitbart.
Breitbart.
The Costco Circular.
What's amazing is
that last one's actually true. I was in the Costco Circular this year.
How did that happen?
That is actually true.
What were you writing about in there? Monopolies.
I did a debate about privatization with somebody. They asked me to do.
For the Costco Circular.
Yes.
It's probably the biggest payday you've had all year. Paid more than journalism.
Probably the biggest audience. Probably the biggest audience, yeah.
That's unbelievable. Yeah. Well, what always has amazed me about you is how prolific you are. From back in the days, you were doing the news over at the late Fire Dog Lake.
Fire Dog Lake.
I mean, you look down here and it's like, oh my God, look at all these pieces you've written. You realize that's just this past week. It's insane. David Dayan, always a pleasure. Thanks, buddy. I appreciate
it.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you. All right. Bye.
David Dayan, ladies and gentlemen, we will, of course, put a link to his Tumblr so you can go. I mean, and the thing is, he knows about everything. The great Los Angeles mass transit restoration. Wells Fargo is trying to bury another massive scandal. Of course, he wrote a book about chain of title. So he knows all about Wells Fargo. Healthcare collapse. Renegotiation of NAFTA is starting to look a lot like the TPP. Billions of student debt could disappear because of lost paperwork. I want to talk to him about that. We spoke about that on this program, where there's a chain of title issue with student debt that he's writing about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I mean, Jesus. All right. Folks, just a reminder, this show relies on your membership to thrive and grow and breathe. It's literally to breathe. We take your membership funds, we directly put it into the oxygen tank machine that we have in the corner. Sometimes you hear the humming. as our soundproofing. It's weird. To become a member of the program, just go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you become a member, you support this program, and we give you additional content every single goddamn day. Every day. And sometimes we even give you a slight little bonus content on top of that. I mean, that's, you know, like the behind-the-scenes video. So become a member today. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Of course, if you need even more content, Michael has begun the process of launching his show entitled Trademark BS. Or what was the other one that we had?
I originally scanned it as too much BS.
Oh, too much BS.
Too much BS. Well, you want it Patreon, in a moderate amount.
Patreon.com, TMBS, bit, The Michael Brooks Show, to support that launch.
376 so far. Thank you, everybody.
376 of you have done that already. Also, if you drink coffee, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy crap from Amazon or Jet.com, head over to MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on those links. Use them always in some manner in which you maybe you can make it easy for yourself in some manner. I wouldn't know how. I'm not sophisticated in the ways of how people remember where they were on
basic browser functionality.
Yes, I have not picked up on that yet. And you will notice no difference, but we will get a kickback. But again, if you can afford to be a member, if you enjoy this show a couple of times a week, 5 days a week, 4 days a week, 3 days a week, 2 days a week, support the program. You will not regret it, I promise you, based upon a lot of survey work that we have done. See you in the fun half.
No, 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 no. Things are looking bad.